Welcome to this Transplanted 10. Thanks for joining in. My name's Cameron Wolfe. I'm an associate professor in infectious diseases in the Department of Medicine at Duke University in North Carolina. And our topic that we're going to talk today is hepatitis C positive donors and their use in hepatitis C negative recipients. Obviously a very topical issue at the moment. The reason it's topical is really, I think, twofold. Number one, we're in a fortunate revolution in terms of hep C therapy, which has really revolutionized our ability to cure patients of their illness, including those post-transplant, which we'll talk about. On the negative side, we're also in the US, at least, in the midst of a really significant opiate epidemic, which has led to a dramatic increase in the number of donors who we see are either dying acutely of opiate overdose and or carry hep C. And so we have to think about how we're going to use those donors in a way that can really maximize transplantation. So I want to start by some definitional changes, which I do know cause some confusion still in the community, although I hope this is diminishing. And that is, what do we even mean when we talk about hepatitis C positivity? And I want to make a very clear differentiation, and we'll talk into this as we go. So we have the luxury now of having two tests for hepatitis C, hepatitis C antibody, and a hepatitis C NAT. And let's talk about the difference before we go further. So an antibody, or your serologic response to hepatitis C, is something that's very different to serologic responses to HIV or hepatitis B. This is a non-protective antibody, so it doesn't protect someone from getting reinfected down the road. And so to see someone as being hepatitis C antibody positive, all that it tells you is that currently or previously that individual has been hep C positive. They may well have cleared, they may well be actively viremic, you won't know. And even if they turn out to be non-viremic, that person can get reinfected. Conversely, NAT positivity in blood really defines someone who's actively viremic and therefore actively infectious. And so typically most of our patients will in fact be a combination of both of these. You can uncommonly get people who are only NAT positive, for example, in the midst of an acute seroconversion, where the antibody comes up late, or in fact, as we've talked about before, someone who's only antibody positive who may have cleared their viremia and become no longer infected, either through natural history and immunologic clearance or through pharmacologic clearance with good drugs. Rarely we see false positive antibodies. So let's talk a little bit about both seropositive and viremic donors in a little more detail. So in 2017 in the United States, just to put a number on the magnitude of this issue, we had the highest number of overall deceased transplants that we've had at any point in the United States, which is terrific, over 10,000. A decent percentage of these, however, were because of the opiate epidemic. So how do we use those organs in the most efficient fashion? So now up to 26% of organ donors in the U.S. will be increased risk donors, according to the Public Health Service classification, and a good percentage of those will be because of active drug use. And at least last year, 775 donors were counted as hepatitis C positive for some reason, and we'll go into delineating which category they fall into. So if you take those 775 and split them up into their subcategories, at least last year, the majority, as we talked about, were both seropositive and viremic, almost 500. A very small minority were probably acutely infected with a positive NAT test, and yet they had not had time to mount the antibody yet, which typically takes a couple of months. And interestingly, almost 300 donors who were seropositive yet non-viremic. And so I want to start by looking at those, because to me, these are the low-hanging fruit in the transplant world where we want to expand our donor pool and do it safely. So let's look just at these group and expand them out a little more. And so last year, through UNOS, DTAC, the Disease Transmission Advisory Council, actually were able to find that, in fact, five of these donors did, in fact, transmit hepatitis C to their recipients. So what's going on there? What's that risk magnified as? In actual fact, when you look at those five donors, every single one of them had an acute reason to be an eclipse window infection. So they were recently potentially exposed to hepatitis C. All of them were increased risk donors. And so if you divide this by the proportion that we know are increased risk donors, we get to about 213, or about 2.5 to 3%, depending on which part of the country you're in. This is very typical to the rates that we would usually quote people for the potential of hepatitis C transmission through the eclipse window if they take an increased risk donor. It may be a little bit higher depending on which parts of the country you're in. It probably is higher a little bit if you're in the region that takes donors from the Appalachian regions up through the central Midwest and up into New England, but about 3%. And so the take-home here is that these donors, to the best of my knowledge, do not pose additional risk of hepatitis C transmission because of their antibody. Their risk of transmission is solely related to their behavior exposure. If it's a donor who died with a needle use reason in recent days, they do carry a risk. If it's a donor who had none of those behavioral risks or had a PHS increased risk stratification that was something very different, distant imprisonment, distant STD, for example, actually probably their risk is very close to zero. Their seropositivity means nothing. Let's talk a little bit about that in a little more detail, because sometimes we get confused by what the NAT test can really tell us. And so if you look at modeling of residual risk opportunity and think about how long a little amount of virus in someone's blood takes to replicate, in fact, typically you expect the NAT to not be able to pick that up until at least sort of 5 to 7 days after a transmission, after an injection drug use has occurred. So when we get a donor who presents, presumably on the day of their overdose, our OPO community is often getting very good at running the NAT test early in their admission. That donor may take a few more days sometimes before cross-clamp has occurred, during which time the small amount of virus that they had may well have risen to a point where, at the point of transplantation, they're infectious, even though the early RAN NAT test gives you the false reassurance that they're okay. So this is just a simple way of saying, not only is it helpful in these donors where you do identify a behavioral risk factor to recognize their NAT's negative, but to understand when that was taken, and when was it taken in relation to the likely incident that led to their terminal illness, when was it taken in regards to when cross-clamps occurred and the donations moved forward. Generally speaking, though, safe donors, we should be using more of them. I'm going to flip metaphorically and literally here to talk a little bit about donors who we know are viremic. So these are people who are NAT positive, irrespective of their serology, although most will be antibody positive as well. We've been transplanting such donors into Hep C viremic recipients for some time, and I'm not really going to talk about that, but I want to start with some kidney studies that were done here in the United States through both the Penn Group. I use the abbreviation of the THINKER study, which, if those of you that want to look up David Goldberg's paper last year in New England, can get a summary of their first 10 people. He's now presented 20. And Christina Durand's paper of a group that called their study the EXPANDER study out of Hopkins, and they were published in the Annals this year. Both used similar treatment strategies, at least in terms of drugs, and would take Hep C-positive donor kidneys and place them into negative recipients who were carefully selected to generally be people who might have had a longer wait list or a more difficult time getting an organ placed if they simply waited for a negative donor. They took different strategies, though, and I think these are worth thinking about. The Penn group took the strategy of saying, we're going to wait for virus to appear. We're going to actually intentionally delay initiation of drug until we see the recipient is, in fact, viremic, and then begin. And oftentimes that was viremic. In fact, all times it was viremic within 3 days of the transplant. And they very specifically also, pre-transplant, made sure they had a genotype test done which restricted their types of Hep C donors that they could use because they, in fact, had a very limited drug panel that they wanted to use. At the end of the day, 20 out of 20 people have reached SVR12 and have had no significant detriment in kidney function as a result. The Hopkins group really took a different approach, and they almost took a sort of a preemptive treatment, if you will. Beginning, they said, we don't care about what genotype it is, irrespective, we don't care initially, although we might modify your drug regimen a little bit depending on what the genotype is that we find out post-transplant. Their timing was very different, though. So, in fact, they began drug when the recipient came to the OR before transplant, enabling them to get a little bit of drug on board their system early on. And, in fact, in some instances, some of their donors never became viremic at any point transplant. Again, the endpoint from our end is 10 people treated and 10 people successfully cured of their virus at SVR12. Worth knowing that both of these groups have now expanded and done a good number more transplants, again, successfully from what we understand, but I'm talking about published data only. So the kidney literature, I think, sort of really led us to clearly say this is in a group of people where we can carefully select potential recipients and we can do it in a timely fashion. What about scenarios where it's more urgent? And so thoracic organs then come to be thought about. And so although there's a number of groups across the U.S. now and certainly outside of the United States who've done thoracic transplants with hepatitis C mismatched donors, I really just want to concentrate on two groups. The first is a group from the Brigham who published presented their first cohort of patients of thoracic recipients earlier this year at the lung and heart transplant meeting. And so they took a very different approach. In fact, not only were they, again, carefully selecting recipients who would be willing to consent for such a protocol, but they, in fact, started drug very early and only gave 4 weeks. So this is important because that's meaningfully shorter time period of treatment compared to the standard FDA approval for these drugs. And their argument is based on some hepatology literature that say actually in acute hep C, where there's very little tissue-related virus at the point of transplant, if you can get drug on at that point, in fact, maybe you don't need the length of therapy. And actually, so far, they've had outstanding outcomes with all of their patients reaching, I think, SVR12 already at the point of cutoff there. And more importantly, no mortality or significant hepatitis-related morbidity. Vanderbilt took a slightly different approach in their heart population, which is to say, when we see someone who we think has a clinical urgency to expand their donor pool, we will consent you to take a hepatitis C-positive heart. And at least in their first publication of 13 patients, they actually took a mixed drug approach, depending on genotype and patient characteristics, and treated the patients after their transplant with some delay, and again, so far with very good outcomes and no hepatitis-related complications at this point. There's other groups who've done similar approaches, almost all of whom have gone to insurance companies for payment. Most of the other groups have started drug at some point post-transplant, unlike the Hopkins group who began it at the time of the OR. So with these sort of studies that are briefly highlighted, generally showing very good outcomes where cure rates are typical for the cure rates that we see with these excellent direct-acting antivirals in general, the question is why wouldn't we really open the floodgates here? And I think there's a few cautions, many of which I think are rapidly falling by the wayside. So the first caution, I think, is that historically the clinical outcomes for transplanting hepatitis C into lung, hearts, and kidneys, not to mention livers, were really actually quite poor. That said, I think we've rapidly reached a point where gleaning much helpful information from historical data taken before about 2014 or 2015 is not comparable to what we have now with direct-acting antivirals. The second concern, which I think is still valid but so far has yet to pan out, is what has that history of hep C in that donor done to the residual organ quality of what you transplant? And clearly that, we recognize, for example, that hep C has a meaningful impact on liver and kidneys. Does that actually translate into a worse outcome for the organ quality? Most of these studies, I would argue, are probably a little bit too early to tell, although preliminarily it doesn't seem to be the case. Again, I suspect that's largely because we're treating them fairly quickly post-transplant. But it may be a difference between a donor who's had hep C for 10 years prior to transplant compared to someone who's recently infected. There is still a subtle social stigma to becoming hepatitis C infected. How that plays out in this sort of scenario, I think, is unclear, but I would just challenge people to say that that still does exist in ways that are subtle, and you really have to sort of ask your patients a little bit about it. It sort of speaks to the idea of consent in some ways. Are people really willing to go through with this? There's been a few tissue-specific concerns that have been raised through past studies. The first was particularly related to heart transplants, the idea of accelerated graft vasculopathy. So far, the Vanderbilt group, for example, have taken very careful examination of coronary artery disease, as have some groups at UCSD, and we'll look forward to their results as they come out. So far, at least, no signal that this will be accelerated. Again, I suspect that's simply because you've treated and the virus is gone. We'll need a little more data, perhaps. Again, based on historical information, this concept of rapidly progressive cholestatic hepatitis was certainly raised in previous experience as something that could really rapidly cause liver disease. That has not been seen yet in this experience. Again, the rates that we typically think of as for this condition to occur were all generated in times when people maintained their viremia post-transplant for extended periods of time. That may be very different when, in fact, we can get drug on board for most people very quickly, treat them out of their illness. You know, at what point does this become standard of care? Well, I think part of that depends on how many people you've actually transplanted. I'm aware of at least 50 cases that have now sort of accumulated between these different studies where this has been done safely, and at least more than 100 that we know of in databases that have been done. The pooling of those at some point, I think, will really help answer one of these other questions here, which is cost, because at some point we need as a community to go to our insurers and say, this is financially in our patient's best interest, and therefore in your best interest as a payer. These drugs are not cheap. As people know, you know, some quoting figures would quote Mavyret or Epclusa here, for example, with treatment costs that range from around $30,000 to sort of $75,000 a course here. These are really meaningful costs that will increase your first year of transplant cost. But if that's, you know, ultimately done to save a certain period of time on the kidney waiting list, then in fact these, I think, can become radically cost-saving. The question of who pays is always important, and I think it's really incumbent upon centers who do this to know how that's going to play out ahead of time. It becomes a real challenge if you've transplanted someone with hep C and then you find you can't get access to drug. In fairness, that hasn't happened yet in any of these studies, mainly because some have been drug company sponsored, others have had insurance cover the drug, but where, for example, the hospital has backstopped the payment should they run into problems. That really, I think, needs to be a center-by-center and maybe even patient-by-patient discussion. Some interesting subtle things that I think will come out of this is, you know, what does all this mean even to things like the KDPI, so the way we assess where kidneys should go? So, for example, this does not currently factor in whether your hep C is treated, whether you're a seropositive non-viremic donor, and in actual fact, I suspect in the future we'll see adjustments of this that factor in hep C treatment. And the final question that really remains very unanswered is, you know, when should we start these drugs? So we have three very different approaches here between groups that have started as soon as they saw virus, typically inpatient, before they saw virus, even before the kidney went in, or in fact, waiting until discharge and treating accordingly. And I think it's too early to really clearly say which of those approaches is going to work out best, and it also may ultimately play a large role as to the cost and implications to patients. So with that, I sort of want to conclude by saying, you know, really the last 2 years have been a radical change in the way we think about hepatitis C treatment. And I do think that we're in a scenario where we can accurately and safely harness what has been an incredibly unfortunate and devastating opiate epidemic, which has led to a larger number of hep C positive donors, but whom can give a really critical gift that is now treatable in our recipients. And I suspect this will fairly quickly become standard of care for multi-organ systems as we move forward. It may not quite be there yet, but stay tuned, it will be soon. Thank you.